The Birds Out Back, a primer on keeping chickens. Over the past decade, more and more Mainers have discovered the joys and challenges of keeping chickens. Experts on this form of husbandry say it's relatively easy, but does take some work to assure birds are kept healthy and happy. And there are some common errors that can bring about the end of your hobby, either by municipal mandate or by the will of predators. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll explore some of the basics of raising a flock, from how to choose the right breed, to finding the right coop, to keeping your chickens well-fed, disease-free, and laying properly. We'll also explore some of the more common mistakes of newbie poultry enthusiasts and answer some of the most common questions. How do I keep my chickens cool in the hot summer months? How do I keep them from freezing come winter? And how do I stop them from eating their own eggs? Keeping Chickens 101. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. It's happening in the cities and suburban backyards, as well as rural farms across Maine. People are raising chickens for food and for fun. Today, we'll learn more about what goes into keeping healthy chickens and why people care so much about these birds. In the studio with me, Lisa Steele. She's an entrepreneur and an author of books about poultry, and she is the founder of Fresh Eggs Daily. Joining me from our Bangor studio, Ann Lichtenwalner. She's associate professor of animal and veterinary science and director of the University of Maine Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. She's with UMaine Cooperative Extension. And Colt Knight. He's also with UMaine Cooperative Extension, where he's an assistant professor and state livestock specialist. And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you tried raising chickens? Are you interested in getting started? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, all of you, to Maine Calling. Lisa, we'll start with you. Why is raising chickens so popular these days?
I think that people are really interested in where their food's coming from. So they started growing gardens, and chickens is just an extension of that. They're small, they're relatively inexpensive, they're easy. You know, it's not like having a cow and having to figure out how to milk this cow. I mean, chickens are just a lot of fun, and they kind of become pets. But then, as you know, they also lay you fresh eggs.
Yeah. Anne, what's your take? I know that this isn't directly your realm. You're more of a veterinary expert on chickens. But do you have a sense of why backyard chickens have become so popular?
Sure. Thanks for the question. And Lisa, I have to say quickly, I'm a fan of your site.
Oh.
But anyway, so I've been in Maine for 10 years. And during that 10 years, I think that the population of the chicken-owning public has gone up by, probably at least doubled or tripled, looking at some of the data I've seen. And why? I think people love birds. Birds are fascinating animals. So they like birds for their entertainment value, for sure. A lot of chicken owners I've talked to definitely feel that way. But then that need to know where your food is coming from, that need to teach your kids that comes out of a bird and not, you know, from a box. I think that's informing a lot of the interest as well.
I like that phrase, chicken-owning public. I didn't realize that was a sector of our community. Colt Knight, any thoughts on that same question?
I would probably just echo what the previous two commenters said about really wanting to understand where our food comes from. We're several generations now of folks being off the farm or closely related to being off the farm. And really kind of lost our sense of where our food comes from. You know, not too long ago, we could ask people, where does your food come from? And they say the grocery store.
Right.
And so I think nationwide, there's an entire.
Sure. So let's Lisa, we'll go back to the basics of even just getting started here for the uninitiated. Which came first, the chicken or the coop? How do you truly get started? What's step number one?
So I always recommend starting with baby chicks. You're going to end up with a friendlier flock. You know, especially if you have children, it's really fun to see them grow. You're going to end up with a healthier flock because you're feeding them from day one. You know what they're eating and what kind of care they're getting. But that also gives you maybe an 8 or 10 or 12 week window to get your coop built. So you can kind of on a whim get a box of baby chicks, bring them home, get them set up in your house with a heat lamp, and then you've got this time to actually figure out where they're going to live once they get too big to be living in a box in your house, basically.
But it's July now, so it's sort of too late for that. You can do it now?
Yes, actually, I have a week-old baby chick right now, and I've got a bunch of month-olds, especially here in Maine where it's so cold. I like to start a little bit later in the season because you don't want three-month-old chickens still in your house under a heat lamp. You know, you start, the warmer it is, and the sooner you can get them outside.
Right. But if you do get chicks, as you said, you keep them inside under a heat lamp because they're really vulnerable to cold at that point. For how long?
Until they have their feathers, 6 weeks maybe. You know, again, depending on the time of year where you live. We used to live in Virginia, and I could have my chicks outside at about a month old because it was so much warmer. Of course, the best way is to hatch them under a mother hen, and then she keeps them warm.
Sure. And I've heard of other people, though, buying pullets. They're like, the teenagers of chicken. And you can get them at that stage later? Is that possible? Or you're saying that there are issues with that?
Well, not issues. I'm just not a big fan. I really enjoy the baby chick phase. And you do end up with much friendlier chickens because you're handling them and your kids are playing with them and they just get to know you. You know, I'm all about that they're pets and they're part of our family and such. You know, if you're just raising chickens for the eggs and they're just going to live in a coop in your backyard and you don't really care, then the pullets are great because eggs are going to come pretty soon after.
Mm-hmm. So depending on the size of the coop and the type of the coop are important. Say you want to have six chickens. Do you get six chicks, or do you? I've heard you get eight because sometimes they
stuff
die.
Stuff happens. Yeah, some don't. Especially if you're getting them shipped. You know, a lot of all the hatcheries will ship you a box of day old baby chicks, and some of them don't make the travel. If you get them from say a feed store or a farm, some of them might end up being roosters. So you should maybe get a few more than you ultimately want to end up with.
So if you had six, how big a coop do you need?
Roughly 3 to 4 square feet per adult chicken. So six chickens for like 24 square feet. Not really 6x4. You know, that's like dog house size, really. I mean, you don't need a lot more than that. Especially here in Maine where it does get cold, you don't want a huge coop that your chickens aren't going to be able to keep warm. You know, okay. You want them with their body heat to be able to warm up the space. And the smaller the coop, the easier time they're going to have.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about the specifics of that. But I want to bring in Anne here. Anne, how do you look for healthy chickens? When you're selecting chicks, are there things to look for? Or how do you get off to a good start here trying to prevent disease?
Sure. Well, I want to just put a very short plug in here for Cooperative Extension. There are poultry workshops at a lot of the Cooperative Extension, events that are held. All of these, we have to give you, a quick, concise answer. But these are actually issues that kind of can take some thought and planning and a little more training. So that's the plug.
Okay.
How do you get healthy chicks? So, certainly you can look at them, but probably best is to get them from the most reputable source that you can. Now, that might be your Uncle Charlie, who's been raising them, for many generations on his farm, and he's got some special breed, in which case those are more or less heritage chicks. So that's very much being dependent on his judgment. Or you could go with the National Poultry Improvement Plan, or NPIP, certification process. A lot of hatcheries will have to go through inspection for several different kinds of diseases in order to get NPIP certification. And it's very worthwhile to seek that certification from any hatchery that you purchase from. And it's not just blanket NPIP certification, but it's certification in the area of certain diseases like avian influenza, mycoplasma, salmonella, and salmonella enteritidis in particular. So those things are important to think about when you're buying.
Mm-hmm. And it's good to learn a little bit about the potential hazards that can go on even in the phase of raising chicks. I remember when I first started out, I learned what pasting up is, which is this thing that happens to chicks, which can be serious, right? I guess if you don't take care of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to explain what? No.
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that? Would you like me to?
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
because I will have to say that Lisa's got a great thing about fluffy butt Fridays on her site. It's hilarious, what she brings up is really a good point that you have to pay attention to looking at the animal carefully, and looking at the back end of the chicken is important, because if they get diarrhea, if they have kidney failure, if they're dehydrated for some period of time, then their feathers on their, what we call it's the cloaca area or the vent area where they defecate and urinate, can really get messy. With chicks, if they have a problem in that area, it basically keeps them from being able to defecate normally. And so when they are what we call pasted, or they have vent gleat, something unusual in that area, then really kind of gently washing them is one of the, and hydrating them, of course, is very important.
Sure. So the point there is you really do have to pay attention to these animals. You can't just sort of let them be and marvel at how cute they are. You do have to watch them closely. Colt.
Yeah, they're not so cute after
that. Yeah. Colt, explain your specialty is pastured poultry. What does that mean, and how does that compare to, example, to free-range chickens?
Well, my expertise, I guess, is last summer at the University of Maine, we conducted a pastured broiler study where we actually compared conventional and slow-growing breeds on pasture to raise meat birds. And that's really, I guess, where my expertise lies, is in the pasture poultry broiler production, the different types of facilities that one would need, and also, you know, how much feed they consume, how much water they consume. And the big question that I had when I wrote this grant and wanted to conduct this study is I kept hearing people estimate how much grass a chicken eats out on pasture. And I said, well, a chicken is not a ruminant animal. They don't possess the physiology to digest cellulose, the cell wall constituent of plants. And cellulose is the most abundant form of energy on the planet. And really, the only animals that can take full advantage of it are ruminants and termites. There are a few other animals that are like a pseudo-ruminant or a hindgut fermenter that have some bacteria and things that can digest the cellulose, and then the animals can use the byproducts from the bacteria. But chickens aren't one of those animals. So we actually measured the forage utilization and estimated forage intake on those animals. And intake was only about 2-3% of their diet. So
not much at all.
Much less than the estimates that I keep hearing.
Yeah. Do you work with primarily, are these commercial operations for meat birds, or can you have a hobby farm, pastured poultry?
Both. We're starting to see a rise in small farms commercially raising pastured poultry for like CSAs and local sales. And also people are interested in raising their own meat and raising some of their own birds.
Sure.
But I mostly work with small farmers that are wanting to raise anywhere from 30 to 800 chickens to sell in the local markets.
Wow. Lisa, go back to breeds here. Given that, you know, Maine has this certain temperature fluctuations and weather, what are some really sturdy breeds that work well, that are easy to care for, that are friendly, that lay eggs for Maine?
Well, we're fortunate here in Maine because chickens do a lot better in the cold than in the heat. So if you live in the South or in Maine this week, you really need to have heat-tolerant breeds, which are a lot of the Mediterranean, the smaller-bodied with the bigger combs. They have easier time staying cool. But really here in Maine, I mean, you have it wide open because chickens, for the most part, do pretty well in the cold. I'm a big fan of the Australorp. They Australorp, Buff Orpingtons, Lavender Orpingtons, they come in different colors, but they're hardy. They're kind of big-bodied girls, so they do well in the cold. They're good layers. They're super friendly. If you are going to eat your chickens, they are considered a dual-purpose breed, so they've got enough meat on them that they would make good eating if you did want to, but if you go into it thinking you're going to eat your chickens and then you fall in love with them like we all do, you know, you can keep them as laying hens also, so you're not stuck into having them be broilers. So I would say Australarps, but really pretty much any breed is going to do okay in Maine. I would stay away from those with the really large combs, though, because frostbite in the winter can be an issue with those kind of breeds.
And what about there? You've seen these sort of more exotic looking birds that have feathers all over their feet. Or is that a problem for Maine as well if they're walking around in snow? Or
could be. They could end up with little snowballs on their feet. But then again, the feathers, I would assume, keep their feet a little bit warmer too. Mm-hmm. So they have, you know, little snow boots on almost.
So it's more it's more of a concern to keep them cool than it is to warm them up. I think many people think, oh, I've got to protect my, it's cold out there, I've got to protect my chickens. But are they more vulnerable in extreme heat?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Much more. We used to live in Virginia, and it was really hard to keep them cool, and I felt badly for them. And here in Maine, you know, we get down below zero, and our coop is not heated. It's not even insulated, and they're just fine. You know, they open the door and they come running out. And but this week in the heat, they've been panting and holding their wings out, and they're really having a hard time.
Yeah. And so how do people keep their chickens cool, I guess, in temperatures like this? Or do they have to do anything special?
Yeah, that's the relevant question right now. And I would guess that, you know, it's possible that if you had some sprinkler systems or something like that where the birds had a choice of getting in and out of that, that might be nice. Ventilation is always a huge issue with birds, certainly in the winter as well. They need adequate ventilation so that, you know, the nitrogenous products, you know, the off-gassing from the urates that, you know, that they leave here and there. Anyway, that goes away and it doesn't get trapped. So one thing that I like to tell people is when you walk into your coop, even if it seems like it smells okay to you and you're thinking, well, we have enough ventilation, I suggest that you hunker down kind of low and sniff, because if you can smell ammonia at that level, then you've got way too much ammonia. You need better ventilation in your coop. So and not stressing the birds, you know, that's important. But I will add, just informed by some of the recent necropsies that I've done in this last week or so, really make sure that your birds have adequate water. Fresh, especially cool water, would be nice. And make sure that there's more than enough so that even the most bullied member of the flock can get a drink when she wants it. So a lot of people only have one water source for their chickens, and it may or may not allow the least dominant bird to get in there at the same time as the most dominant bird. So please watch out for that.
Yeah, so the pecking order is a real thing, and it can be a danger for the chicken at the end of that order, right?
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Again, the number to join the conversation is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Tandem Coffee, celebrating conversation, coffee, cheddar biscuits, and no Wi-Fi in Portland and at tandemcoffee.com. And Theater at Monmouth, presenting The True Story of Little Red for families now through August 16th. Tickets at theateratmonmouth.org.
You forget the car keys on the kitchen counter. The babysitter calls to cancel as you're running out the house. Some curveballs affect you for a few hours, others for a lifetime.
I just did something extremely wrong, and this isn't right. And I knew I had hurt myself.
Stories of reinventing yourself on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Hidden Brain, Sunday morning at 11 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. What is your special hidden corner of Maine? Are you willing to share it? Send us a picture of your hidden corner and just a few words describing what it means to you. We'll put your photo in a virtual picture frame and share it with Maine Public's audience. All entries will be entered to win a day on the coast with Maine Coast Heritage Trust, a statewide land conservation organization. Celebrate the importance of Maine's natural wonders with us. Go to mainepublic.org and click on events for all the details.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, all about raising chickens. Joining me here in Portland, Lisa Steele, author and founder of Fresh Eggs Daily, And in our Bangor studio, Colt Knight, state livestock specialist, and Ann Lichtenwalner, veterinarian and director of the University of Maine Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. Join the conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. First on the line with us now is Rob Sanford. He's a professor of environmental science and policy at the University of Southern Maine. Rob, thanks for calling in today.
Sure.
Hey, so we understand you are going to be teaching a course focused on the chicken. Can you tell me about that? What about the chicken is the center of your teaching?
Oh, actually, we've been teaching the course for 4 years now, my colleague Cheryl Laz and I, and it's really about how the chicken can be a focus for preparing students for college learning.
Okay. Explain how.
Well, if you think about the chicken, there's many different aspects of it that are appropriate for study. For example, there are labor relations in chicken factories, there's egg production, there's chickens in history, chickens in art, many aspects of the chicken.
Hmm. What might surprise people to learn about the significance of the chicken over the course of history?
Well, there are many exciting little things. Like, for example, sailors used to tattoo pictures of a chicken in crate on their feet in hopes that it would help prevent them from drowning. Roman generals would cut out chicken entrails and use them to forecast how battles would go. And the chicken has been important in scientific research on understanding evolution and medical treatments.
Wow, who knew? So this is the question that opened the show. I'll ask the same of you. Why do you think there's such interest in raising chickens these days?
Well, how many pets do you have can give you something, an offering, and not have it hurt them? Well, plus, they are the dominant meat source in the United States and often throughout the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
E.B. White, a famous chicken keeper, said, "Don't try to convey your enthusiasm for chickens to anyone else." But we defy that in the teaching of this course. And many of our students come out and we take something that seems almost silly like that, and then we show them how there are many different sides to it that an academic can take, from mm-hmm. bird flu and zoning, cultural symbol and metaphor, many aspects of it.
Yeah. Now, do you raise chickens yourself?
I do, and I accidentally confessed that weakness to a colleague, and that led to the course.
That's how these things come about, I guess. Well, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Rob Sanford is a professor of environmental science and policy at USM. He'll be joining Maine Calling later this month to talk about rural landscapes, a second appearance by Rob. Thanks very much. I do want to follow up on something that he mentioned, Lisa, which it was ordinances. So before, I guess, you even set out to order chicks, you should find out whether or not your town, your municipality, allows you to keep chickens.
That's very true. And again, fortunately, here in Maine, it's very rural. And, most areas allow chickens in pretty much unlimited amounts. But it is, especially if you live in say, Portland or the outskirts or somewhere a little bit more urban, it is always a good idea just to call. Hopefully get in writing, just know what you're allowed, what you're not allowed. Sometimes there's ordinances for the coop where it can be, and if you need permits and stuff.
Yeah, and before, we're going to take some calls here, but there's a certain etiquette to this, right? You can't just sort of set up your coop and hope that everybody in the neighborhood likes it. You should break it in gradually, check with them, offer them eggs, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the neighborly thing to do. I think that backyard chickens are getting very popular, as you mentioned, in a lot of urban areas. And I think that the downfall would be if chicken keepers forgot their etiquette and, just started letting the chickens run the neighborhoods and ruin people's gardens and stuff. So you should always be considerate. And bribing your neighbors with eggs is a great way to get them to like your chickens.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, though, if your chicken, we mentioned some of the diseases or problems that can arise. It's not like you can take your chicken to the vet, right? I mean, how do you deal with that? Do you have to educate yourself, or are there vets?
Well, actually, you can take your chicken to the vet.
You
That's
can.
One of the beauties of having an animal that fits in the car, in a box in the car. And many, many companion animal vets actually don't mind seeing chickens and keep up to date on important chicken stuff. So one of the jobs that I fill, our lab does necropsies on chickens, so we try to help guide people if they're losing birds, both larger scale producers and smaller scale producers. But the other thing we try to do is also link them with a veterinarian. The thing is that, you know, these birds are fascinating in their own right, but they are sources of food. And so they are legally, you know, more or less seen as food-producing animals, even if they all have names. So there are some issues now that, like, the FDA gets involved in saying what you can or cannot use to treat your animals. Many of the antibiotics are no longer available for us as owners. So we have to get a vet involved in the act if there's something that is going on that's serious.
Sure.
It's good to have a relationship with a veterinarian. That said, most of the things I see are relevant to how people manage their birds. And so, training yourself, as you suggest, in good, proper management of birds is a great idea. We have a website, University of Maine, it's umaine.edu/veterinary lab, and we put up some information on bird health and current issues that are things that owners should think about, and we also send out information about best management practices for bird owners.
Sure. Got a few calls coming in. We'll go to the phones now to Laura in Bangor. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
I'm just calling. This is a good topic. I'm actually a small animal veterinarian in the Bangor area who does actually see pet poultry and backyard poultry as part of my practice. In fact, I have one coming in this afternoon with a broken leg. So we see a variety of things, kind of like Anne was talking about, and we do have to be careful about some of the medications we use, but we absolutely can treat pet birds and even just backyard poultry birds.
Hmm. So this is more and more common for, cat and dog vets to branch out into chickens, or are they chickens, poultry pet chicken specialists?
I think it's more common, certainly around here to see dog and cat vets who actually, we sort of seek out, that extra education. And I did do a little bit of extra education in vet school with poultry, because I have a personal interest and have birds myself. So I think it is more common, but it does take some knowledge. They're not by any means related to cats or dogs. There's a variation. And there are, those cares you have to take with certain medications that you can and can't use, which I think is really important.
Sure. All right, Laura, thanks very much. Let's go to Elizabeth in Winthrop. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. I was just calling because I want people to understand, if you're going to be raising your birds primarily for eggs and for entertainment or your kids or whatever, to understand that chickens actually live a lot longer than people think. I mean, my birds, I have a very healthy flock of about 56 heavy breed hens at my house with one rooster. And they can live to be like 12 and a half years old. And as a matter of fact, I just had a goose die this past weekend that was 12 and a half years old. And also wanted to make sure that people know that if you have the space, it's not a bad idea if you're going to free range your chickens to also raise geese with them. Because I have found that since I've had a flock of about 9 to 10 geese, I've not had as many kill-offs from predators as I did before, because the geese are very good at not just defending themselves, but also notifying the hens or the rooster that, hey, there's a hawk coming in or there's a fox coming in, run for cover. But the main thing is just I have actually expanded my flock primarily because people get chickens thinking that they're going to enjoy doing it, and the first winter they have them and then they stop laying. They don't realize that if they just put a light out in the coop and make sure the chickens are warm enough and have enough water, they will get eggs all winter. But a lot of people just oh, they stopped laying, so they're no good anymore, so we're going to get rid of them. And that's how I've actually gotten quite a few one-year-old pullets that continue to lay for many, many years.
Hmm.
So I want people to know it's a long-term commitment, not just a one-time little, you know, trend.
Yeah, sure. So a couple of points there. One, which we do have to get to here, and I'll ask the group, about predators. In my experience over the last 10 years keeping chickens, this was issue number one. I thought I was very good at protecting them, and I just failed at every turn. When predators want in, Lisa, it seems like they can get in. Maybe I wasn't doing it right, but it was a real challenge. How big of an issue is this for novice poultry keepers?
I think it's the number one issue that people underestimate. Predators. In fact, I have a friend who started raising chickens in Portland this past year and thought that her fenced-in backyard was going to be sufficient because she lives in a neighborhood, not realizing hawks, fox, raccoon, fisher cats. I mean, anywhere you live, there's going to be predators. And the last caller made a really good point about the geese. You know, whether you have dogs or geese or some kind of animal that will not only help protect your chickens but also give an alarm. Bottom line, free-ranging is probably not going to end well in the long run. So a run that's completely covered and the fencing is sunk into the ground is going to be a lot safer. But ultimately, you have to lock your chickens up in a coop at night.
Yeah.
You know, a coop that nothing can get in, not a bear, not a coyote. They really need a lot of protection from predators.
And just a little hole, something can get
weasels,
in.
Weasels, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yep.
Colt Knight, what about on larger scales? How do you keep predators from attacking, you know, large groups of birds that are essentially, you know, outside a lot of the time?
Well, the main thing you got to do is prevent the predators from actually getting to the animals. So when we do like a pastured poultry project, you'll actually put a perimeter electric fence around your animals. And that in of itself is a deterrent, but it's not 100%. You know, there's a lot of different things you can do to keep predators out on top of the electric fence. Guard animals, for one. You have to train the guard animals to be with the chickens, or else the guard animals may kill more chickens than the predators will. So you can't, you know, you just don't go out and buy a donkey or go out and buy a dog and stuff it in with the chickens. They've got to be trained animals. Preventing critters getting into your fence is really tough. So if you've got the electric netting around your property, you can actually take like some cans of cat food and stuff and tie them into that fence, and the predators will be attracted to that cat food sense, and they'll get zapped by the electric fence. And what you're essentially doing is training the predators to stay away from the electric fence. So that's a neat little trick. But when we get down to the coop level, this is the area I see that people underestimate the most, because chicken wire has got about an inch or an inch and a half hole in it. And that's big enough for a raccoon or a weasel to put their arm through and grab the chicken. And they will pull them out in pieces if they can't get them out in a hole. So when you design your coops and things, you don't put the animals right up close to the chicken wire. You want to use like a quarter inch wire or something small that they can't get through, or put up little deflectors. You know, a lot of times what's really common is you'll see that folks will put a board or something up for a perch in the corner, you know, to make a 45-degree angle. Mm-hmm. So the birds will get up there and go to sleep at night right by the fence, and the raccoons and other predators will just reach through the fence and grab them while they're sleeping.
Yeah. Ron writes in, "We're residents of Falmouth, beginning our experience with a dozen chicks, just transferred to a freestanding coop in the backyard. The coop and the run have been well protected against ground predators, but we wonder if we need overhead protection as well to protect against winged predators. The coop and run are approximately 30 feet, within 30 feet of the rear of the house and garage, in full view of the inside of the house. What do your guests suggest for protection?" I guess at least at the top is important.
The
too,
run needs
right?
to be covered, of course, yeah. Yes. Yeah, a lot of people forget that part. Hawks, eagles, owls can fly in, raccoons and foxes and fisher cats can also climb up and over the fence. So your top of your fence, your top of your run does need to be protected, just like the sides and just like Colt said, chicken wire is not going to work. A dog can rip through chicken wire. A coyote can rip through it. You need something half inch or smaller.
And you have to go down into the ground because they will tunnel under as well.
Correct.
So how far down do you put the fence in?
There's a lot of rocks in Maine.
Yeah.
So we went down about 8 inches, and then we kind of angled the wire. Because when a predator hits the wire, they're not going to think to back up and try again. So they're going to hit it and hopefully give up.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take another.
Keith.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sure.
Oh, sorry. I just had a very quick note. To not to forget wild birds. So sometimes it's good to actually have a solid top on your coop, because wild bird defecations coming from the air or from birds sitting on your coop top can pass diseases along. And we don't want to see that here in Maine. We didn't have any avian influenza in the 2015 outbreak that happened here in the United States. And we hope that we keep escaping that. So having our flocks be more biosecure would be terrific, and that's one way to do it.
All right. Excellent point. Thank you. So we are going to take a quick break. First, a word about tomorrow's show. We'll be rebroadcasting our popular Summer Reads program. Tune in to hear our panel offer their top book recommendations. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Many immigrants say they're anxious and fearful. Even people in the U.S. legally say they feel they could be deported or separated from their kids.
I'm beginning to worry. I wasn't worried before. I was angry. But right now, I'm beginning to worry. And I think they're after us. I really do.
I'm Elsa Chang. The toll on Latino Americans amid the border crisis. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, not too long ago, the radical Islamist group ISIS controlled vast parts of Syria and Iraq. Now largely expelled from those countries, ISIS left a legacy of brutal violence, extreme religious discrimination, and widespread destruction. Hear from the New York Times journalists who reported behind the lines of the war with ISIS and learn what they discovered in secret ISIS documents on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how to raise healthy chickens. Joining me, three chicken experts, Ann Lichtenwalner, Colt Knight, both with UMaine Cooperative Extension, and Lisa Steele with Fresh Eggs Daily. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566. Michelle on Facebook asks two questions. One, how do silky chickens do in Maine in the winter? Are they hardy enough for our cold winters? Also, my other question is, I have a herding dog who loves herding but is not formally trained in herding. Would she stress out the chickens if she tried to herd them? Should I train her traditional herding or train her to leave them alone before we get backyard chickens? Lisa, silkies first.
Silkies, I'm going to pass that question on to Ann or Colt because I have never raised them. But okay. As far as the herding, we have two herding dogs. We have a German Shepherd and a Corgi. And they both have never been really formally trained, but we did the sit, stay, leave it, drop it, that kind of thing. We don't let them ever chase the chickens or touch the chickens or, you know, they know boundaries. They can't go into the coop. They can't go into the run. I would think that a dog herding your chickens would probably stress them to no end. So probably not a good idea.
Yeah. Colt, silkies, or Ann, either one?
Silkies work fine in Maine. Normally, when we talk about cold stress in the coops with different types of birds, the one thing I wanted to really mention was perch size, because most people will get like a small stick or a small diameter dowel rod or something to make the perch, because that just looks like it fits their feet better. And the way that they insulate their feet when they go to to their perch is they sit down on it and their feathers overlap around their feet. So if you have a small diameter rod, their toes and things are on the bottom of that rod, and when their feathers get all around their feet, the bottom of their feet is exposed to the cold, and that's when you get really severe frostbite in their feet. But if you were to take a 2x4 and lay it flat and use that as a perch, they can put the whole surface area of their feet on top of that, and when they sit down on it, their plumage covers and insulates their entire feet, and that really helps with the... And just like in the summertime, ventilation is important in those coops.
So do you think
Yeah,
I was wondering if some people some people might think they need the small, you know, the broomstick handle because they need to grip it in order to stay up, but they don't.
That's one of the most common misconceptions. I'm glad that you brought that up, Colt, because I use the 2x4s with the 4-inch side facing up, and people will see pictures of my coop and they're surprised that I use that as a roost because they think it should be a round, more like a wild bird or a parakeet would sit on.
I think I did that. I'm confessing now. All right, let's go to Susan in Newcastle. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling because I had 6 hens. And 3 of them, one in particular, got really sick. I took her to a vet in Brunswick, and we did an x-ray, and we tested her, and then we had to treat the whole flock with antibiotics. And I'm a little freaked out because, like, anything they could get into, I don't know if I can clean it. Everything in my backyard enough to keep them that safe. And I'm wondering if there's two questions. So one is there something I can proactively do? Because I am in Tennant's Harbor in the summer, and it's like just a whole different scene for them. And the second thing is I have 2 ducks that live with my 3 remaining chickens. My chickens didn't die of a disease. They got taken out by a predator. But anyway, those are my 2 questions. Like, how do I deal with this? And you know, any tips on dealing with ducks and chickens in the same space?
I have ducks and chickens. We've raised our ducks and chickens together for almost 10 years, and some experts recommend not keeping them together because they do have a little bit different care that they need and that. But I found that it works for us okay, and I actually like the body heat of the ducks in the winter with the chickens. But your yard, I think what you're asking is about things in your yard that they could eat or get into. I found that they know what's good for them and what's not. So we have azaleas, we have foxglove, we have lupin, things that are toxic to them, and they've never eaten them. I think unless they were starving, you know, they wouldn't eat things that were toxic. You obviously don't want things like wire or, you know, nails or screws or pieces of metal or things that they could step on or ingest accidentally. But I don't think you need to necessarily, like, chicken-proof your yard or worry so much about that.
I always worried about whether they...
If I may.
Yeah, sure, go ahead, Ann.
Oh, sorry, Keith. But I do have a burning issue here. And this is based on experience here in Maine. People should, if they're going to free-range their chickens, test their soil for lead. Mm-hmm. Because we live in a beautiful state with a lot of older housing, and much of that housing now has vinyl siding, but much of it also had lead paint for many, many, many years, and people scraped and repainted. And chickens go around, and they're obsessive compulsive little guys, and they're always looking for something different, and a lead paint chip looks great, you know, and they ingest them. And I've tested eggs for lead, and I've found lead in eggs in Maine in the past. And I don't want to do it anymore. So, and I don't think people should have to test their eggs for that. They shouldn't. But what they should do is if they're thinking about free-ranging their birds, they should talk to your local, or a cooperative extension has a soils lab, but try to find out if you can simply get the, you know, get samples of soil throughout the yard, get it tested for lead.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Just to make sure.
And to add on to that, if you do free range your chickens, you should not be using any herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers. You need to be really careful what you're applying to your lawn if you do have free range chickens, because they will be ingesting all that you're putting on your lawn.
Now,
you're eating your landscape.
Right.
Right. If you don't free-range them, do you have to make sure they have access to gravel? They have some source of gravel to put in their...
They do. They need the grit that they use to grind up their food because chickens don't have teeth. And something when I moved to Maine I did not think about was that the ground is frozen and under the snow for like 8 months of the year. So that first winter, I had to go out and buy commercial grit, which makes me crazy because I don't like spending money on things. So, you know, if you do live in Maine and you don't want to buy commercial grit for them, you know, scrape, if you have a dirt driveway, scrape up some of the dirt from your driveway. Or if you have a dust bath for them in their run area, maybe, you know, they can get the small stones and pebbles and things from that. But they do need access to some kind of ground or dirt or grit or something.
Sure. Let's go back to the phones to Dean in Harpswell. Hi, Dean. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. We've got six hens, two Buff Orpingtons, two Plymouth Rocks, and two Rhode Island Reds. And one of the Rhode Island Reds, Avery, the smallest one, is getting bullied. And the question has to do with how to deal with the bullying chicken in the pecking order to remove the bully or remove the bullied, and also how to reintroduce a chicken. After you might remove it.
Mm-hmm. Remove the bully. You never want to remove the one who's being bullied unless it's, you know, if it's getting bloody or she's getting injured or whatever. But you really want to take the bully out and give them some timeout time, a couple days, a week or whatever, and then put her back and see if that kind of knocked her down a little bit. But, I mean, that can be serious. Chickens can literally kill each other over pecking order issues. So it's nothing to be taken lightly.
Yeah, Colt, I was curious, on a larger scale, is there a pecking order in a flock of 50 chickens, or is it less of an issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you're dealing with livestock, you're going to have a pecking order issue. And generally, the way to get around that is to make sure that they have adequate space per bird. That's generally where most of those issues come from. And then sometimes you just get one that's a jerk, and you just take those out. If they're being a danger to the other animals, I just remove them, you know, make supper, chicken and dumplings. Good choice.
You know, yeah. Another thing that we do sometimes, if we had I was the advisor for our poultry club at University of Maine. It was the University of Maine Cooperative League of University Chicken Keepers. The acronym was CLUCKS. But anyway, we had problems with some pecking issues. And so what we did was we took Dremel tools and we learned how to very carefully trim the beaks of the birds, all of the birds, actually. And so we blunted the beaks, which helped quite a bit. You have to be quite careful not to trim back into the sensitive tissue. So it's kind of like trimming your dog's nails, except touchier. Mm-hmm. But it worked pretty well, and that and then there's some stuff that's available at the feed store that is basically a aloe vera based gray colored goo that works beautifully to mask the affected pecked area, and other chickens are less interested in it. So that combination works well sometimes.
Yeah. Dean, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you. That's great. Except we did as we have made mistakes all along. It seems newbie mistakes. We're only 2 years into this, but removed the bullied, and she's been pecked horribly, and we've been using Blue Coat, which also works really well. But she's neck feathers are quite in bad shape. Thanks for we'll try removing the bully though.
All right. Thank you, Dean. Let's go to Sylvia in Camden. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I live in a residential neighborhood here on a street that's fairly well traveled, not a lot. And my friend and neighbor has chickens who wander around. They wander around the neighborhood, and I love having the chickens come over in my garden and putter about. They interact with the cats, and it's just a delight. I've been here 10 years and never ever had any problems with a chicken getting hit. You can, when cars come, you can kind of see down the distance if there's chickens on the side, and the chickens are very streetwise. It's amazing, and they're a delight to have around. I have to watch it when I go out and have some breakfast. I sit in my low lawn chair and have my toast on a plate, and if I'm not looking, the chicken will just grab my breakfast. And it's just really fun to have the chickens.
All right, Sylvia, thank you. She seems like a great chicken neighbor.
Yes.
Darcy writes, chickens have a lot of benefits, not the least of which is that they eat ticks. Now, I've heard this. People have, you know, in the Lyme era have said, oh, let's get chickens. They'll eat the ticks in the backyard. How true is that, though? Is that a real safeguard against ticks? Do they really like them that much that it works?
They do eat them because we've found a couple on our dogs, and I've brought them out to the chickens, and they will eat them. They don't eat all bugs. They eat a lot of bugs. Guineas are supposed to be better, guinea hens, for the ticks. But I think chickens in general and ducks will eat a lot of bugs, a lot of bug larvae. So you'll cut down on all your populations, you know, your mosquitoes, ticks, whatever.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go
There's actually a scientific study out of Africa that demonstrated that chickens aren't effective tick control.
Interesting. Okay. You still want to do the other things to protect yourself from ticks and not rely on your chickens alone. Let's see. Let's go to Colleen in Corinna. Hi, Colleen.
How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
This has been very interesting. Thank you, guys. I just wanted to point out, in Maine, we do have another resource that is really an interesting resource, and it's the Maine Poultry Connection on Facebook. And it is a Facebook group that was started by Scott, and his last name, I believe, is DeMornville. And he's in the Bangor area. He actually just started a chicken store out in Bradford. And it's a wonderful, wonderful group because people can live ask questions to each other. And there are some really knowledgeable chicken people in this group. There's vets in this group. And it's really, and it's a no drama zone. You know, like some of those Facebook groups, they get into a discussion, it gets heated. It doesn't happen here. These are just really nice, down-to-earth chicken people. And it's really interesting. Last night, one lady had an egg bound, I believe. And all of a sudden, this other lady's like, I know where you are. I know where your town is. I'll come over and help you. You know, it's just, it's a nice resource to have.
So you're not alone. That's great.
You're not alone in chickens right. In Maine.
Colleen.
Cooperative Extension has been wonderful as well. When we first started getting into it, we went and met with Cooperative Extension in Bangor.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, Colleen, we're out of time here. But I did want to ask Lisa about her upcoming, you have a new book coming out.
I do.
Yeah, so now's your time to plug that before we
Okay,
before we
so I have a book coming out this fall called 101 Chicken Keeping Hacks, and I'll show you how to reuse your feed bags, your egg cartons, your old feeders and waterers, and just kind of use things, recycle, upcycle, and make your chicken keeping easier and more economical.
All right, and we'll look for it. And with that, we're out of time. Lisa and Colt, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it. Lisa Steele is an entrepreneur and author of books about poultry. She's the founder of Fresh Eggs Daily. Anne Lichtenwalner is with the Cooperative Extension. She's associate professor of animal and veterinary science and director of the UMaine Veterinary Diagnostic Lab. And Colt Knight, also with Cooperative Extension. He's an assistant professor and state livestock specialist. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had help from George Thomas and Rich Tozier. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today, though, will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, great summer books to read. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.